Please open to Amos chapter 5, verse number 18, where we are going to resume our study from yesterday. Amos is the shepherd turned prophet who is warning, particularly northern Israel, that God's judgment against them is about to fall and that they need to repent. They need to choose life rather than the death and destruction that is coming in the future. And there's a little warning that's woven into the prophetic book here. For those that might be cheering for the death and destruction and judgment that the day of the Lord is bringing against sinners. And I think it is something we, as believers in the New Covenant time, need to take under advisement as well. We should be looking for and hastening the day of the Lord, the second coming of Jesus, because we know that will bring an end to all the difficult times that we're going through and will be in the presence of the Lord forever and ever. And that's all good stuff. What we should not be celebrating is the judgment that will be brought on that day against all the unsaved. We need to have hearts of compassion like that of God, where he says, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, where he says that he would rather that all repent and come to the knowledge of the truth. That's the same mindset all of us should have. When we think about the day of the Lord coming, it should grieve us to realize that real people, men and women who have come into existence into the form of God, when God pulls the plug, these people will end up spending eternity away from God. And that should grieve us, not make us happy. And so even when we're talking about the little judgments of God, the small days of the Lord, of history, such as the Assyrian invasion of northern Israel and the Assyrian exile of northern Israel that takes place in the 8th century BC. There should be no celebration of how people are going to die during this event. So this is what God says to the good people that might be tempted to take that bad attitude. Woe to you who desire the day of he who is. Why would you have the day of he who is? It's darkness and not light. It's as if a man fled from a lion and a bear met him. So you're running away from a lion, and just when you think you might get away, a bear cuts you off and mauls you. So there is no hope. That's the idea of the day of the Lord. If you are in his judgment, there is no hope. Or went into the house and leaned his hand against the wall, and a serpent bit him. So a guy's running away from some other threat, and he runs into a house and he closes the door and he puts his hand up against the wall, kind of breathing hard, and some sort of poisonous viper jumps out and bites him fatally. That's the idea of the judgment of the day of the Lord. There is no hope. Verse 20. Is not the day of he who is darkness and not light, and gloom with no brightness in it? So think about that when you think about the day of the Lord, the ultimate day of the Lord. The people that we know who are still outside of faith, who still refuse to have a relationship with Jesus Christ, when that day comes, when the last trumpet is sounded and Jesus appears in the sky, those people that had the choice but refused will be eternally lost. They're done. And so we as Christians should want the day of the Lord to come for all the right reasons, but we should grieve over the coming of the day of the Lord for all the right reasons as well. The loss of hopeless people. All right, back to the text here, where Amos is speaking on God's behalf against the northern Israelis who have been engaging in a false faith. They've been worshiping the golden calves, and they've been having a form of godliness, but denying the power of it. They've not been in true relationship with the God who created heaven and earth, who brought Israel out of Egypt and brought them and put them in the promised land. So God says to those false religionists, verse 21, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. So God doesn't like their get-togethers in his name. Even though you offer me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fattened animals, I will not look upon them. So it doesn't matter how many things you sacrifice. I'm not paying attention because your heart is not right with me. So worship is not beneficial to the worshiper unless the worshiper's heart is right. Verse 23, God says, take away from me the noise of your songs and the melody of your harps. I will not listen. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. So God wanted these people, instead of going through the motions of religion, to actually live the faith. You know, false faith has activities. It has ceremonies. But their hearts are not right. And they go away from these ceremonies and these activities, and they live like they want to live. They live selfish, self-centered lives. And God says, that's not what I want. I want you guys to be fair with everyone. I want you guys to be righteous in all that you do. I want that to be like water flowing everywhere. Verse 25. Did you bring me sacrifices and offerings during the 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? So remember back in the 40 years wilderness experience, they had the tabernacle. And every day, those hundreds of thousands of Israeli family leaders would be involved in worship ceremonies, worship services, where there would be sacrifices offered on their behalf. And God says, you remember that? You remember how you were doing that? Verse 26, you shall take up sikkut. Now, sikkut here in my English Standard Version is capitalized as if it is a proper noun. I think that's probably not the proper way to do it here. Sikkut means tents or tabernacles. And since we're kind of talking in the context of the tabernacle in the wilderness, what he's actually saying is here, you took up the tents or the tabernacles of your king or Molech. Now, Molech is a slight variation on the pronunciation of the word for king in Hebrew and its related languages. Molech was the god of the Moabites and the Ammonites, the descendants of Lot, and he was worshipped by as a really weird, twisted worship of the god who destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. The way he was worshipped was you got drunk and you had sex, and the babies from the last time that this happened were then burned up as sacrifices to this destroyer god to let you live. And so it's a twister in remembrance of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and how God saved one family, and that family became the origin point for the Moabites and the Ammonites. So apparently, at least some of the Israelis had their own little private shrines to Chemosh Molech during the Exodus. They'd worship God at the tabernacle, But then they'd go back and they'd have their own little private worship of Chemosh Molech. But it wasn't just that. Verse 26 goes on, and Giyun, your star god. Giyun was he was a Middle Eastern god. It's a local name, a Babylonian name, I think, for effectively the god Jupiter, the planet Jupiter. It was supposedly representative of a certain god, and so these people had their own little private shrines to this god. And the Israelis, the whole time that the 40-year wilderness experience was going on, they were worshiping God at the tabernacle and then going back to their tents and having their own little private ceremonies for their own little gods and goddesses. Images that you made for yourselves, the rest of the verse says. Well, I will send you into exile beyond Damascus. So the warning in Amos is, look, you guys have been going through the motions for a long time, ever since the wilderness. You worship me on one hand through the tabernacle, but back in your tents, that is your ancestors, some of them, were worshiping other gods and goddesses. Now, let me read to you the quote of this passage that occurs in the book of Acts. And I think it helps you see why I went the direction I went with the wording. Because the English Standard Version, along with other English Bibles, go with the Masoretic Hebrew text, which is actually not as old as the text that underlies the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. So in Acts chapter 7, verse 43, the Septuagint is being quoted, and it says, "You took up the tent of Molech and the star of your god Rephan." And Rephan appears to be just a slight misreading of the Hebrew word Kiyon, which is the Babylonian equivalent of the Roman god Saturn. So you took up the tent of Molech and the star of your god Kiyon, the images that you made to worship. Well, I'm going to send you into exile beyond Babylon. So that's the Acts chapter 7 quote from the Septuagint. And so this is a clear prophecy from Amos, from God through Amos, to these people living in northern Israel. Because you're keeping up the same thing that your ancestors did in the wilderness, you know, worshiping me supposedly, but actually worshiping other gods and goddesses, I'm sending you into exile up into Mesopotamia. So that's what he who is, the whose name is the God of hosts, is going to do. Amos chapter 6, verse number 1. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. Now, from time to time, God throws a little warning down to the southern kingdom, who has also got issues along this way. They're not as bad as the northern kingdom yet, but they're heading down that path. So every once in a while, he reminds them, I've got my eye on you too, and you need to repent. You need to learn from what happens here with the judgment against northern Israel. If you don't change, it's coming your direction as well. So woe to those who are at ease in Zion, a reference to Jerusalem, to the Temple Mount, to those who feel secure on the mountains of Samaria, the notable men of the first of the nations to whom the house of Israel comes. So this is a warning to everyone in leadership, everyone that has some part to play in the judgment that's coming. Verse 2, pass over to Kelne and see. And from there, go to Hamath the Great. And then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Now, these three places have something in common. They were all very important cities of the Middle East at some point in their history, but all of them came under assault and attack and fell. They all suffered judgment. And so God says, you need to take note of where judgment has already fallen. And then he asks this question, are you better than these kingdoms? Or is their territory greater than your territory? O you who put far away the day of disaster and bring near the seat of violence. So God says, you think you're better than them? Well, guess what? Same thing's going to happen to you. You think that you can keep out of trouble? Well, you will suffer the consequences of your choices. Verse 4, woe to those who lie on beds of ivory and stretch themselves out on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and, like David, invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. So this is a description of all the people that are fat and sassy in northern Israel. They think they've got it made. They're all enjoying their lives. And when they get warning about impending judgment, they just laugh about it. They just keep it up. They just keep doing what they want to do. Verse 7, therefore, they shall now be the first who go into exile, and the revelry of those who stretch themselves out shall pass away. So they're going to lose all of this stuff that they're enjoying right now. Whenever the judgment falls and all their stuff is taken away, and they, if they survive, will be taken into exile by the Assyrians. Verse 8, he who is God has sworn by himself, declares he who is the God of hosts. I abhor the pride of Jacob and hate his strongholds, and I will deliver up the city and all that is in it. So God is made sick by all of this self-centered activity, this failure to live by the covenant. And he hates the way that they're just digging in their heels and refusing to repent. And so he's going to hand them over into this judgment. It's not going to make him happy, but it needs to happen because they've gone too far off track. Verse 9, if 10 men remain in one house, they shall die. And when one's relative, the one who anoints him for burial, shall take him up to bring the bones of the house and shall say to him, who's in the innermost parts of the house? Is there still anyone with you? He shall say, no. And he shall say, silence. We must not mention the name of he who is. Now, this is a little vague in the way that we read it. And this is what effectively we're talking about. Remember earlier that only about 10% is going to survive this Assyrian invasion. Only about 10% are going to be around to go into exile. So if there's only 10 people in a house, then they're all going to die except one. So when this one guy that's left is being talked to by people coming to do the burial, they're going to say, so is there anybody left in there? There's nobody hiding in there, is there? And he's going to answer no with an oath. Says, I swear to you by the name of he who is, there's nobody left in the house. And the response to that is, shut your mouth. Don't you even use that name. That's going to be happening during this exile cleanup, this roundup of the survivors. Verse number 11. For behold, he who is commands, and the great house shall be struck down into fragments, and the little house into bits. So again, this idea that only a small portion, a small remnant of northern Israel is going to survive to go into exile. Do horses run on rocks? No, they don't. The horse rider tries to avoid rocky ground. Does one plow there with oxen? No, you don't. You try to stay away from the rocky ground when you're plowing. You'd rather be in a much more open field area. Do you but you have turned into excuse me, but you have turned justice into poison and the fruit of righteousness into wormwood. So you've done the stupid stuff. You've tried to plow on rocky ground. You've tried to ride your horse on rocky ground because you're taking God's justice and you're turning it into poison. You're taking God's righteousness and you're turning it into bitterness. You who rejoiced in Lo Debar, which has the idea of nothing. So you're pumping up nothingness like the golden calves, who say, "Have we not by our own strength captured Karnaim for ourselves?" Apparently, some sort of idea that they had a victory in the past, and so they're putting all their confidence in that. They think that they have had victory before. I mean, they've survived all these years, assaults by the Assyrians and by the Syrians. Well, they're not going to get through this one. Verse 14, "For behold, I will raise up against you a nation, O house of Israel, declares he who is the God of hosts, and they shall oppress you from Lebo Hamath." So that's the entrance into Hamath, which is, it's the northern point of occupied northern Israel. It's a little bit north and west of Dan. "To the brook of the Arabah," which is a reference to the Dead Sea. So probably that's a reference to a river that's draining the southern border of eastern northern Israel. Chapter 7. "This is what he who is God showed me. Behold, he was forming locusts when the latter growth was just beginning to sprout. And behold, it was the latter growth after the king's mowings." So this is a series of visions that Amos sees of what might have been. But then Amos begs God not to do it, and so it doesn't happen. So this is an illustration of where God says, "This is what I could do, but I'm not going to because it would be too hard. It'd be too rough. It would go over the line of my promises." So the first thing is locusts coming in and eating everything. Verse number 2, "When they had finished eating the grass of the land, I said," so he just saw in his vision every bit of vegetation chewed up by these locusts. And so he cries out, "Oh, he who is God, please forgive. How can Jacob stand? He's so small." So he begs God, "God, don't let this happen." He couldn't handle it. And of course, God already knows that. He wants Amos to see, though, and pass on just how bad it could get. So, verse 3, "He who is relented concerning this, it shall not be," says he who is. Verse 4, "This is what he who is showed me next. Behold, he who is was calling for a judgment of fire, and it devoured the great deep and was eating up the land." So, fire raging everywhere across northern Israel, everything being burned up. And so Amos says, "Oh, he who is God, please cease. How can Jacob stand? He's so small." And he who is relented concerning this also shall not be. So God says, "Well, I could have all the land chewed up by locusts, but I'm not going to. I could have all the land burned up, but I'm not going to." Verse 7, "This is what he showed me. Behold, the Lord was standing beside a wall built with a plumb line in his hand." So a plumb line is an old-fashioned vertical level. You got a string with a heavy weight on the bottom of it, and you put it in place, and the weight of the string against, because of gravity, drops straight down toward the center of the earth. And so you've got a nice straight vertical line. That's how you make sure you got nice straight vertical walls. So verse 8, He who is said to me, Amos, what do you see? And I said, a plumb line. And he who is said, behold, I am setting a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will never again pass by them. The high places of Israel shall be made desolate. So God says, I'm going to put a measuring tool against Israel to see what's straight up and down, what is upright. And then judgment's going to come. And once that judgment is gone, then we'll move forward. Verse number 9, the high places of Isaac shall be made desolate, the sanctuaries of Israel shall be laid waste, and I will rise against the house of Jeroboam with the sword. So God is going to bring absolute judgment against the last dynasty of northern Israel, against Jeroboam the second. Then verse number 10. Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, remember this is the golden calf, Bethel, sent to Jeroboam, king of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words. So now Amos's judgment theme is getting out. And his most recent prophecy is against the dynasty of Jeroboam himself, that there's going to be a plumb line put against Israel, and Jeroboam and his family will not survive that measurement. And so Amaziah, the priest of the golden calf altar at Bethel, reports that to King Jeroboam and says, Amos is talking about your family being done in. And the land of Israel can't put up with this. Now, when we come back tomorrow, we'll talk more about Amaziah's report to King Jeroboam.